Alan Kring Productions in association with Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 5, delivered on September 3rd.
Today, financial statements. And before I get to that, as usual, we will have a look at the markets. That's grim. Starting this out, just to press the matter a little bit. Madam, who won today, the Bulls or the Bears?
The Bears.
The Bears. Was it a little bit of a win or was it a...
It was a big win.
Yeah, it was strong. As I told you, 0.3% or more is pretty significant. And here we had a head-beating exercise. Interestingly enough, the impact was the greatest on the small caps, but then the largest caps on the Dow were whacked, and of course the S&P 500 came by, relatively speaking, in better shape than the two heavies on the front and back end of the world markets, of market caps in the country, I should say. So we're having a rough patch, and as usual, you will have explanations. Well, it was because of this, this, and this that this happened. And if I go down, I'll bet you'll see something about the trade with China talks. Yeah. Retail stocks with his new China tariffs, the president. And that is definitely weighing heavily on the markets now because the pain is just beginning to show up in the markets. And, of course, if you were to look at what I had shown you last time, the Treasury, find that. As you can see, the day today, we have this amazing slide off in the market in the yield curve that we don't see unless there is going to be a really, really bad economy down the road. And again, as I had shown you before, yield curve dynamic at stock charts.com, you can see the extent of the inversion. It is just amazing that you have something like this, not seen before in our lifetimes, yours or mine. We have a yield curve that is inverted, and you have the 30-year yield actually below the 3-month yield, which is just appalling that something like that could happen. How would it even happen is the question. And what does this mean? It means that we will have a severe recession, and probably that will be in full force about when you're trying to get your jobs. So get ready for some fun out there looking for a job. Get to the internship fair. We're having it later this month, and I'll be there. If you're going to go to the internship fair, I will be there. And if you need me to take you up to someone and introduce you, I can do that for you. Or if you're just nervous, I can kick your ass and wake you up. But get credentials behind you now because it's going to be a rough market. Not only is it going to be rough because of unemployment, from a recession, we're also getting deeper into the problem of jobs being replaced by these machines now, these artificial intelligence machines, which are going to start wiping out jobs in accounting, finance, management, you name it. So there's that. Every time you pick up your mobile phone and think, isn't this a wonderful world to live in? Think about what the implication is on the rest of your life, being second to a machine in line for a job. But that's your problem, not mine. Now, just as a caution to you, sir, are you easily offended by words that I use? Okay. Accounting. There, I said it. I know. You're going to be over at the dean's office complaining. The reality is that accounting drives a lot of other analyses. Accounting creates information products for a variety of constituencies. Now, these information products are the result of strict rules that are laid in according to generally accepted accounting principles, consistently applied, generally accepted accounting standards. And that means that we can rely upon these financial statements to be made from one company to the other in a very consistent fashion. Now, who uses the accounting statements, those financial statements? Well, accountants do to a certain extent, but they're producing them for someone else. The board of directors and the executive management use them, need them. Investors, both those who are currently investing in the stock or lending money to the company through bond purchases, they use them. Others that use them. The employees, to some extent, might use them, but there are external groups that are consumers of these information products. Among them are the government, which requires for public companies that those financial statements be prepared, promulgated, and that they are all nice and clean and pretty, and done in very specific formats, very specific. Unions, labor unions use them. For example, there are wonderful stories of companies that have cried that they were losing money and they had to cut wages. And then the union people looked at them and said, don't give me this. Right here, you just raised the salaries of your executives and gave them massive, insane bonuses, and then you want to cut our wages? Try again. So you got those kinds of people. You also have other constituencies out there. Environmental groups oftentimes will look at financial statements. Consumer advocacy groups will look at financial statements. International organizations will look at financial statements. Researchers will look at those financial statements. So those statements have a lot of consumer constituencies, each having its own agenda for looking at those financial statements. In finance, we take them, but we have to fix them in very specific ways using best practices. And then after we have done all this repair, some of which you'll see in Thursday's lecture, we then go on to do analysis on them, which means that we have to go beyond numbers. Numbers start us out. We need the numbers. We have to do the formulas and the calculations. But that's just the very beginning for us. From there, we got to figure out what those numbers mean. And that's what I do in this class. Every time, what's the market doing today? Okay, don't just give me a number. Tell me what it's saying. And you'll be doing this a lot in this course. Breaking that number out of its chains and making it something that is actionable in your lives, in your investments, in your choices of where you're going to work, and all of that. So there's that part of it. That having been said, though, okay, and I've said all of this before, and I'm going back through this again at a deeper level than I did the first time last week or the week before that. First things first is making sure that financial statements say what they're supposed to, that they are not lies. We have had a history of, even after the regulations cracked down on the scoundrels and the scammers and the liars and the cheats, in the 1930s we did that, and I'll go back through that briefly, we still have liars. We have misrepresentations in financial statements. Some of them caused unbelievable catastrophes, destruction of wealth, ruination of families. Enron was a good example of that. So we had to pass more laws to tighten it up. Then there were ways around that. The first, Enron led to a reform called the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, sometimes called SOX. The Sarbanes-Oxley. But that wasn't enough. The party kept going. This is the reality of both individual and corporate life. Never assume intentions, only capabilities. Is the organization or the person capable of lying and cheating? The answer is usually yes. And so we have to fashion law and enforcement of law based upon what they are capable of doing. Sarbanes-Oxley left holes. So we then had to go to another law later, Frank Dodd. And the problem with this whole reality is that it damages honest, good, small in its wake. The same police that enforce laws against true criminals are also likely to take down some decent, innocent people in their path. And that's what Frank Dodd has really done. It has caused a lot of ruination and disruption of corporations, all because of the cheaters. But there we go. We'll talk about that later and when I get to ethics. But now, all of that aside, and then sometimes, unfortunately, the government is in on it with a lie. In 2008, I and some other analysts who were considered fringe were screaming bloody murder that we were on the verge of an apocalypse in the financial world. We were largely ignored. Now, here's what was going on. We were looking at the financial statements, audited, qualified by the SEC, the Federal Reserve's regulators, the U.S. Treasury's regulators. They were all saying, these 10 banks, these are their true financial statements. And those financial statements were, there wasn't any even a question. Those banks were dead. They were walking dead. They were destroyed. They were just functioning shells. Their financials were so bad. And I called, and other investment advisors said, short the hell out of these stocks. Get out of those stocks if you're long in them. And run for the hills, because when they collapse any day now, the entire world is going to collapse. Well, that didn't happen. We looked like stupid fools, idiots. We were laughed at. In 2010, it turned out that there had been a program in place since 2007 that was funneling money in the back doors of these banks from the Fed. By 2010, it had added up to $7.7 trillion. Trillion dollars. That's why these banks were alive. That's why, and we didn't know it. There was nothing on the financial statements that showed this backdoor welfare on a scale beyond imagination. It was discovered quite accidentally when there was some filings with a court, and a news organization found an email that referenced this thing that was going on. And that news organization reported it, and the 10 banks went to court and said, stop that from being published. They were joined by the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve, which agreed with them. This shouldn't be told to everyone. Well, that judge in Washington, D.C., in the District Court of Washington, D.C., said, go to hell. It's going to be published. So what happened? Not a whole lot, except that what was unknown was now known. And that backdoor infusion is still going on to this day. They are the recipients of, at this point, probably, I mean, we don't know exactly, probably $15 trillion to keep them alive. Because the government has decided that we can't let them fail because that would cause an apocalypse. So there you are. Believe the financial statements as you must, but always know that even the good guys are bad guys sometimes if you're not the most important thing on their agenda. Now, let me take you to the first round of that. By the way, if you're interested, I assign a series of articles about this to my advanced finance class and challenge them to justify that kind of lying, which they have to because they're in the business. They're going to be in the business. Okay, now, let me take you through, and this all has to do with financial statements, but I have to take you through a story. And some of this I've already told you before. All of the scams, the cons, the merchants of cheating and ripoffs were having their heyday in the 1920s, the roaring 20s. With a blind eye from the government, which said that the best regulation is no regulation, laissez-faire, leave it alone, markets, free markets are the best markets, government intervention is always wrong. Well, that led to the crash of 29 and the Great Depression and a whole lot of pain and suffering. And the threat that our country would be taken over either by the leftists, of the communist leftists who had already scored a victory in Russia, or it was going to be taken over by the filthy Nazis who were prowling around the United States having wonderful rallies for their Adolf Hitler. So we had to find a middle ground. Regulate the hell out of these things because they are capable of doing bad. So we had a pair of laws in the reform era. The Securities Act of 1933. And its follow-on, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Now, these, of course, have been amended, you know, over and over again to fill in holes, and there are other laws that have been put into place as well. Now, the Securities Act of 1933 dealt with the primary markets. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934 dealt with the secondary markets. And an agency was founded from these acts. That agency was the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. Now, here's the thing about that. And I'll tell you an interesting story here. You see, when you pass a law, when Congress passes a law, it really doesn't mean anything. You see, Congress passes some law, the president signs it, and we have a nice signing ceremony, and everyone struts around and brags about it, goes home, the politicians do, vote for me, I stood up for God and country and all of that. Actually, it doesn't really work. Because you can pass a law, but who's going to monitor and who's going to enforce it? Well, the government will. The government is just a shell. Within the government, you have to have someone do something. Specifically, with respect to laws that have to do with industries, you need something that is going to have expertise. You need someone who can, you need some organization within the government that will go, first of all, interpret the laws for those who are impacted by it, and then will enforce the law. An example of this happened at the internship fair 2 years ago. I was walking around, and I'm not kidding, I will be there if you want to get some help, have me drag you up to someone and say, here's a student, hire him or her. But I had it, there was the a state attorney there looking for interns, state attorney. And I thought, well, this will be interesting. I thought, you know, I'll just go up and chat with him. He said, I said, well, you know, would you be interested in some finance majors or accounting majors? He said, that's what I'm here for. I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, then he went into this story. He said, look, every year I send hundreds and hundreds of low-income people, most of them young people, to prison, sometimes for the better parts of their lives. He said, I'll send some kid who was scared to death and pulled out a gun that wasn't even loaded and got $200 out of a robbery. I'll have him 25 to life. I'll have some trailer trash screw up and they're trying to cook meth and they nearly burn their skins off. And so we take them, and after they get out of the hospital, we'll send them to prison for a long time. He said, and then I'll have some person call me and say, you know, there is a bank that is dealing in criminals' money, laundering, and the bank officials will call and say, we don't know what to do. We want to call someone to prosecute this. And the state attorney says, we don't know. We don't have any expertise. We can't do it. We're sending people to prison for meth, for robberies, for breaking and entering. We don't have time for $50 million in fraud. Well, who do we call? Well, call the Highway Patrol. The Highway Patrol, the Illinois Highway Patrol says, what? We can't, you know, this isn't our job. We deal in murders and car accidents. You see, there is no agency that actually will break the backs of these bad guys. And so they roll on. And the society gets more and more divided between the haves and the have-nots because it looks for all the world like the laws are on their backs and not the people in suits. In the case of these securities laws, the SEC was a federal agency. It could take the laws and interpret them and say, all right, corporations, this is what this means and this is how you abide by it. And then if there were serious violations, then the SEC could civilly prosecute. And then if it was serious, they could package up their evidence and move it to the U.S. prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, for criminal prosecution. But it all hinges on having an effective agency that has people trained in finance and accounting and then has the machinery to actually monitor and, if necessary, to enforce the laws. And I'll bring up that twin concept of monitoring and enforcement again in 2 weeks. But right now, know this. The SEC, it goes through cycles in how it addresses. In my time, the SEC was actually, they would always start, well, we cannot give advice to you. And then they would help me out with, you know, I was a consultant. I helped small companies go public and be public. So there was more of a, helping hand, and I don't want to use, I make that sound like they were my buddies or anything like that. They still would have cracked down on me, but they did save my ass in the end from some really bad stuff because they knew that they knew who were the bad guys, who were the good guys. But anyway, so there's where it all begins, is with an agency that requires that everyone abide by rules. Now, within this framework, you have to get really detailed for companies, especially under the Securities Act of 1933. When a company goes public, these rules have to be really specific and detailed. But know this, that the SEC isn't the only thing that's doing enforcement. States have their own divisions of securities. From my own experience, they are generally assholes. That's its technical term. Why? Because they are mostly run by people who are not trained properly and who have political ambition, well beyond just working at the state division of securities for a while. I tell you a story now because the statute of limitations is out and the one person is now passed on. But at one point, I was identified by a state as being one of the bad guys. I was trying to do something that was illegal. They didn't know exactly why it was illegal, but this one regulator who had a master's degree in English in this Division of Securities of Utah was quite convinced that this had to be some criminal thing that was going on. What was being done was that a public company, had died years and years ago. And these players, and they were players, they would find these dead public shells, as they were called. And then they would find a living private company and reverse merge it into the dead public shell so that it became a public company without going through the necessary rigmarole of the Securities Act of 1933. You got the idea? Well, the problem with this was that these private companies were generally run by people who had no clue. They thought it was so cool because once they were a public company, they had access to the capital markets of the world. We're a public company. They had no idea that the Securities Exchange Act kicks in and then for the rest of eternity, they have to do filings all the time, forever and ever, quarterly, annual, special filings. And these companies, they weren't doing them, and that's when I was called and said, help, because we just got a letter from the SEC that they're going to turn us into a bunch of aardvarks and fine us $15 million too. Yeah, how long have you been in this public shell? 2 years. And how many K's and Q's have you filed? What are those? Oh dear, we've got a problem. So, anyway, that sets the stage. And then this division, this regulator was after me. And finally, one late afternoon, almost evening, in my sad little office in a sad little building on Olentangy River Road, just outside of Columbus, Ohio, I got a call from this regulator. He wanted to play detective. He was going to try to talk to me and trick me into saying something that was incriminating. We talked for about 45 minutes before I was able to turn the conversation to something a little more personal. And it turned out that he was very religious. He was a Mormon. And then I said, I've wanted to convert to Mormonism. I really do. Kid you not. He started explaining things to me about the religion, their beliefs, and I said, stop, let me write this down, and several times. And then he vowed he was going to send me literature, and I asked him where the nearest tabernacle was. And we talked for another 40 minutes about family and friends and beliefs, and I never heard from him again about this prosecution. True story, brah. Like I said, amateurs. God, that was fun. Anyway, okay, now let me go on. Here's the thing. Going public, there are actually two different approaches, attacks. Let's start this. I actually have a corporation. It has 1,000 shares of stock authorized and 500 outstanding. I own all of those. It is a close private corporation. Not public. I don't have to do filings with the SEC or anything like that. Now, under certain exemptions in the Securities Act of 1933, which I went through, you can sell stock to raise capital, but they have to be very specific how you do it. They can't be amateur investors. They have to be well-informed or have someone who can inform them well. So what I'm going to do here is, madam, I'm going to sell you. I need some capital for my Emergent Light Studio company. So I am going to sell you one share of stock for $5,000. You, madam, two shares. I'm not going to sell you any. You look dodgy to me. Okay. You, three shares. And I don't know. You, yeah, I'll sell you 10 shares. But you don't get to sit in my seat at my office. It's Corinthian leather. Okay. I have not gone public. This was a private sale of stock. Now, over a period of time, the company is making some profit, and I'm plowing it back into the company. The company is growing. And then you start getting fussy with me. I should like to sell my stock to someone. I said, well, you can't. If you look at that certificate, it has a big red stamp on it, restricted. Under Rule 144, you cannot sell that stock. You're stuck. It says it's a rule called Rule 144. You can't sell that stock. And so you're starting to get really fussy with me. You stop by every now and then and tell me how unhappy you are. I need that money for something. I mean, good heavens, I did sell you some stock. And you know, now your wife has had your seventh child, and you're still living in your mobile home, and you want to put an expansion on it, maybe buy another mobile home and make them like an L, and then cut out the walls between them. You know, that would be great. Yeah, and then maybe make four of them around, then you'll have a little courtyard and indicator, and you know, the whole nine yards. And then you can make sort of this burn pit in the center where every Saturday night you can have everyone from the trailer park come and you roast a pig that you have pinched from the farmer down the road. But you can't, because you can't sell that stock. Well, and I said, well, we're not a public company. Well, I actually could become a public company. Now, remember I told you that you go public with an IPO filing on Form S-1, I can sell new stock. However, I could actually register existing stock on something called Form 10. Now, you'll recognize that 10 because I've already talked to you and shown you 10-Ks and 10-Qs. They come from the Form 10 or from an S-1. You see, a Form 10 is actually pretty much a Form S-1 without a prospectus, because you're not selling stock with it. All you're doing with a Form 10 is registering existing stock. And if the SEC qualifies it, you can then say that stock is freely tradable. Of course, I still have to get a ticker symbol to do that, on an exchange. But then I could actually become public that way. Here's the upshot, though, and I think I already mentioned this to you. I could actually go public and sell new common stock and sneak in your stock to get registered with the stock that I'm going to sell. It's a piggyback. And you need to watch out because there are public offerings. If you look carefully, you'll see that there is stock being registered that already exists, which means that you're getting watered down when you buy that stock. Automatically, those insiders are getting their stock registered too, and you better believe they're going to sell as fast as they can to recover their investments. As a matter of fact, I think it was in this class or my morning class, I was just running through these financial statements I was showing you, and it struck me that the number of shares outstanding was more than they sold in the public offering by a noticeable amount. That must have been shares that were registered that had already existed as Rule 144 shares through beneficial ownership of the founders. So that's something you've got to watch out for, is that even if it's an IPO, they're going public, there could be seasoned stock that's slipping in. One way or the other, though, this begins eternity. You must disclose and disclose and disclose. If you miss a deadline, you will get your ass smacked hard by the SEC. There is no patience for this at all, because what will happen at this point is the first thing that will happen is, okay, there's the K's and Q's, the 10-K's and the 10-Q's. They are technically amendments to your original filing on day one of public existence. Every Q is an amendment to the Q before it. Every K is an amendment to what came before it. So that as the life of the corporation proceeds, everything is amending off previous representations as the company changes and grows. And then there's other ones you have to file, like the 8Ks. The 8Ks are declarations of non-recurring events. Like, for example, you're the CEO and you die. That's an 8K. It's also a funeral and an expensive flower arrangement for you, but the party afterwards was hella good. Okay, but I mean, you can have them for all kinds of events. Of course, a bankruptcy would probably be something that would be in an 8K, things like that. And to begin this is our big, big thing: transparency. Nothing is hidden, no lies at all, and laws that will crack down on those who try to lie, so that we have the world's capital markets come to us because we show everything. Not only do we have the transparency, we also have the rule of law. No person, no corporation is above the law. And when we violate that, we rattle the world's markets. When we act like immature juvenile delinquents, that scares the world, because we are, believe it or not, at the end of the day, still that shining beacon, for God's sake. And so when these countries, I talk to these countries, work with them, teach ministry officials from West Africa, the Caribbean, Central America, we say, you need to stop hiding things. When investors can see everything about corporations, when they know that the courts will defend contracts and uphold the rights of owners of corporations over other interests, when politicians are not corrupt. That's when we can start to move money into your country from all those places on earth that have quadrillions of dollars or whatever capital to put in. That's when we do it. And so when I say, okay, let's see the, in one case I said, I want to see the financial aid of the corporation. Well, they will disclose some of them to you. Okay, you let me know when they're ready to disclose everything. Well, you know, this, we are a different culture. You're applying your Western standards. Well, guess what? Western standards have the money. Sorry. So that's the reality of it. So be cautious when you think that wild and crazy delinquent behavior is a great thing. The world's going to take its money elsewhere, which it is starting to do now. I was teaching in Central America, and there's an awful lot of money that used to come here that's now down there. Skyscrapers going up everywhere. Banks getting money that will make sure that the people of that country live better. Old torn down slum neighborhoods being swept away and people being put into better places. Okay, now, moving to this. The repository is at sec.gov. They require that public companies show everything, and then by golly, they make them available to anyone in the world through what is called the EDGAR filing system. Now, I've cautioned you before on this. If you're, okay, now let me go back for the podcast. You go sec.gov. Now, on the menu bar, you go to filings. Do not click. Just mouse over. Just mouse over. And on the filings, mouse over, you'll go down to the second tab, and that's company filing search. Now, on the left, you'll have, you can, in a strip window, you can type in the company name. On the right strip window, you could type in the ticker symbol or the CIK, which is sort of a unique identifier. I caution you against trying to do it by company name because many companies can have the same name. Watch this. Let me type in Sears in the company name search. Uh-oh. Which one of those is the right one? Well, you could prowl all day. You might not find it. You see, those, actually, many of these are the same company, although not all of them. So you're just asking for clicking the wrong one. As a matter of fact, some years back, I did it this way stupidly, and I clicked on the wrong company. It took me about 5 minutes to be completely mystified by the financial statements before I realized I'd clicked on the wrong one. And so being me, I explained to them that I had intended to do that to show them how it could. They didn't believe me at all. So it is better if you type in, if you're looking for Sears, you type in SHLD, Sears Holding. Now, if you don't know what that is, there's a lot of what the ticker symbol is. I mean, heck, you can go over here to Yahoo Finance and type in Sears, and it'll suggest. What to do. So there's that. I mean, or you can go, we have a ticker symbol lookup in our Milner Library online resources. You can use that as well. But anyway, now I'm going to pull up a company here at near its beginning. Uber. Okay. A Q. Oh! Well, look at that. There's the spooky one, the actual S1. Uber went public in April, and there it is, the real deal, what I've been talking about. As I said, I did only one of these in my life, and it was way too much like work. Now, we can look at an actual S1. Now, if you click on documents, usually it's the top one that's the core document. These are hyperlinked. The exhibits and tables and graphics are hyperlinked from these other files. They'll be in the core document, and they'll be referenced, or there'll be a link that shows it in the main document, but its actual physical existence is in another file. It's a lot like how we write web pages these days. What you see there on my web page, for example, that picture that you click on to go to the Apple iTunes, excuse me, that's actually in the embedded code. That's calling a picture file and saying, show this on the website. That's exactly what's happening here. In the main document, it's referencing these names, and then those names show up as a table or a picture or something like that in the main document. But here is an S1. And we used to do these on paper. It's boilerplate stuff. Oh, there's red. What would that be called? A selling document that can be shown but can't be used to sell. Do you remember what that's called? What? No, it's called a red herring. It's a prospectus that can't be used for a prospectus because it has not yet been qualified by the SEC. So this is Uber's red herring. You see, back in my time, you were not allowed to put posters in these. Pictures. God, he's ugly. And he isn't any better. What the hell? Oh, look at all this nonsense. You see this? But anyway, this is the real deal. A full S1. Look how long this thing is. And we used to write these. I mean, I was ahead of the game because back in the 80s, very few people knew how to do things like, there was a word processing program that was awesome back then called WordPerfect. It was destroyed by criminal acts of Bill Gates and his crew. Yeah, they committed crime. They deliberately did it. And they knew that they would get by with it until they were so big that they couldn't be sent to prison. Now, look here. Oh, look at these digital signatures. Chief Financial Officer, Chief Executive Officer and Director, Chief Accounting Officer, Chairperson of the Board of Directors. Sarbanes-Oxley. They have to sign it. So if there are lies in there, all that the prosecutors have to do is take them to court. Is this your signature? Yeah. And they're in prison. That's all there is to it. The SEC is not very strongly enforcing, except with little companies. The big companies have too many lawyers around them to protect them these days. But this is, ideally, they are putting blood on the line by signing these documents. SOX made them do it, so that not just the internal auditors have to sign off on the financial statements, the actual officers and directors of the company have to sign off on these filings with the SEC. Including the very first filing, the S1. Now, real quick, now I'm going to do that with another company because honestly, I don't trust this. And I'll show you why. Okay, here was their filing on S1. Oh, look, the SEC spanked them with letters. Deficiencies in the filing. Remember I told you about deficiencies? Look here. And there is the S1A, the amendment to the original. That was where they fixed them. And then the SEC sent some more documents and more documents. Oh, a confidential treatment order. Damn. An S-8, where they say, we've got stock we want to register so we can give it to our employees. An 8-K, special announcements of non-recurring events. And, well, spank me right there, the 10-Q, the First Amendment. And they've got two 10-Qs. There will be one more 10-Q. And then there will be a 10-K, the annual. Each one an amendment to the one before it. This Q is an amendment to the S1/A. This Q is the next amendment, addition. This one, the next, and then the 10-K fills out the year with the annual information consolidated from the quarterlies. That's what it is. That's how you do it. You live, and it's forever. Once you go public, yes, you have access to the capital markets of the world. You can sell stock, and investors throughout the country and even in other countries can come and provide you with the capital that you need to keep going. But the downside of that is that you have to do this. Now, understand that many of you will work for public corporations. Look at the scale of this document right here. The S-1. And this would be for a 10-K. No, let me get off this. Let me get out of here. I'm going to give you a company that's going concern. TGT, Target. Now, here is their last 10-K. It was filed March 13th of 2019. That tells me that, you see, a company's fiscal year doesn't have to be a calendar year. It just drives me crazy. You'll have companies that end their fiscal year on June the 30th, September the 30th. There's some company, I can't remember what it is. Their fiscal year 2019 ended on January 1, 2019. So they're now in their 2020. And it just something inside me just finds that just drives me crazy. But anyway, Target probably has a fiscal year that is a calendar year. How do I know that? Why do I suspect that? Because they have to get that 10-K out. At least I think it's still within 90 days of the end of the fiscal year. So since they got it out in late March, yeah, that probably indicates to me that they were a calendar year company. So the annual K is showing up about 3 months after that. Okay, no big thing there. But look at this thing. I'm going to go to the document. And again, see this thing? This is very normal. The top one will be the document itself, and then these will be hyperlinked by reference, other files, graphics, tables, sometimes something else, I don't know, exhibits, PDF files, and they'll show up in the main document as calls from these outside files. And see that? We were never allowed to use colors. Yeah, I could have just seen me using colors. And this is every year they have to do this. Every quarter they have to do the quarterlies of this. You could very well be involved in this process no matter what your major is. Because a lot of corporations, the accountants and lawyers, don't create all of the pieces of this. These are done by committees in the company. You might be in accounts receivable. Okay, we put you on the team that's going to build up the current assets that will be then sent, the numbers for the current assets that will be then sent to the accountants. You might be in the mail delivery room. Yeah, that'll work. But they might call you up to be someone who collects information for one of the sections of this report. And you work in teams. And it's just part of the hustle and flow of the company throughout its life. You are on these teams and committees. Now, one interesting thing about that, and I've heard this from more than one executive, saying we do it that way because not only is it efficient, because all of these collectors get the basic raw information together, and then that gets it efficiently gets it to the accounting and law people. It also gives these people the understanding of just what they are in. They're in a larger entity, and they are functioning to help that entity stay healthy, that corporation. And it gives them a sense beyond themselves. It gets them over themselves and makes them understand that they're part of something big and part of something very important that has to be done. Even if their part is just accounts payable or accounts receivable or something like that, or making up this graphic that'll go in the document, they all get a sense this is part of the, we're doing this because we're part of this corporation. Okay, now, very quickly, and I've said this before, one part of this that is really, really useful to read is item 7, the management discussion and analysis of financial condition and the results of operations. This is where the company tells its story. And the people who write this have a very long history of being quite honest and quite glib about what is going on. Okay, we were doing well in these regions. We did poorly in this region. The reason we did poorly is because we suck in that reason. Our management was not acceptable, and here's how we're going to deal with it. Or these ratios for our company are below the industry average. Or here's our trend in our sales. It's not as good as we expect, and here's why. Or it's not as good as the industry average. They really, really do try to make some really good disclosures in this. And if you're looking for a job and you go to an interview and you have read the management discussion and analysis, the MD&A as we call it, you're a mile ahead of anyone else looking for that job, I guarantee you. Well, not anyone else. You could probably have some Rain Man who does this just because he's that way. But this is how you find out how to look knowledgeable for the company. Now, don't be a jerk about it, but at the same time, you can ask darn good questions, and you can discuss things that other candidates for jobs can't discuss. Read the company's own words, and you know that those words are probably going to be pretty honest because they're filing these with the SEC. So that's just a little bit of advice that can get you a long way when you're trying to impress an employer. And it also breaks the ice, too, because it's a talking point. But anyway, okay, now, let me take you back off this. And, of course, you can, as I've shown you before, interactive data, you can click on that. The SEC requires that all companies filing with the SEC have to make their documents available to look at by clicking on the financial statements and choosing a document, or you can download the whole stupid thing. And this goes on and on and on. There are so many tabs, and again, let me point out again, this is just the numbers part of one single required filing by one single public corporation. Let me know when you want to stop. Everything down to what, it's not quite down to how many bolts are on each machine, but they will show you the breakdown of everything from every cost to all of the executives' compensations, and the details of them, it's all there. What the list of all their property, plant, and equipment, all of their borrowings, all of their investments, every detail is there. It's almost transparency overload, which is something that we're beginning to talk about as a horrible problem. There's so much information now, we can't deal with it all. It's just insane. And so we're relying on machines to find stuff for us to look at. But that's a disaster once they are AI and they start deciding to alter our perception by showing us only data they want us to see. Okay, taking that all away, God. I'm going to do the ugly thing. I'm going to talk to you about accounting just for a little bit. Five, and I'm going to get this off the board because it even creeps me out seeing this much. Look, in our world, in finance, the numbers are just the beginning. I mean, you can have numbers poured at you all day, but if you don't know what they mean, if you don't know what they're telling you to do that's actionable, then why do it to begin with? So everything we do in accounting, this is where we begin, but for God's sake, this is not even past step one on our road. We have to think about things. But the financial statements, the core statement is actually the balance sheet. Everything else feeds the balance sheet. Now, you might not have heard this in accounting. They don't see it this way. Come to think of it, financial analysts really don't think about it very much at all. But the balance sheet is the core. And it has other financial statements that feed numbers into it. So, you have another one called the income statement. Now, it comes under different labels. Statement of results of operations. Old school, we called it the profit and loss statement, P&L. Now, what this does is it is a giant calculation that comes down to a number. That number down here at the very bottom is the earnings. That earnings thing feeds to another called the statement of shareholders' equity. Now, in that one, it has, now understand that we used to have very specific names for everything, and anymore there are different names for the same thing. Now what this one does, this one collects how much shareholder money has accumulated over the life of the company. And then it adds in, and they call this money the retained earnings at the beginning of the period. And then we add to that the current earnings minus the dividends and that gives us the retained earnings at the end. Now I don't want to trivialize this, and I know you've seen this before. And I know you all committed it to memory, and you probably have it on laminated paper on your refrigerator. But this number goes to the balance sheet. And at the same time, though, the earnings feeds across to another one, which is called the statement of cash flows. I'm beginning to lose my will to live doing this, but it's important to see it. Now, the statement of cash flows pulls numbers, and then that flows to the balance sheet as the cash change, the change in cash of the company. So in other words, the income statement, the statement of shareholders' equity, the statement of cash flows, all feed into the balance sheet. These are all rivers. They're flows of money. Like, and just like any river, it will flow to a reservoir or to an ocean or to a lake. The balance sheet is the lake, the holding pot, the static. At the end of this, at the end of these rivers, this is the lake, the balance sheet. By the way, just real quick, sometimes you'll hear me, old way of statement of cash flows, we used to call it sources and uses statement, the sources and uses. And if you look at old financial statements, you might see that. Just like the income statement, you might see an old statement that says P&L, that's profit and loss. And then there's finally one over here, just get this one in your notes, the notes to the financial statement. Very poorly mentioned, this is where you can find out a whole lot about a company. Executive compensation might be mentioned there. How much trouble they're in with a lawsuit might be there. A lot of information. In fact, they might even say there that they are in serious trouble as a company. They might say it in the notes of the financial statement. So this is something to keep an eye on. And that's in those tabs. There are a whole bunch of those. Each one of them is one of those notes. So with that grueling background, we can go on Thursday. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.